The three-year-old child's wrist was thinner than the iron pin meant to hold the shackle in place. In 1791, Saint-Domingue was not a tropical paradise. It was a carbon copy of hell where the French calculated that a human life was worth less than 5 barrels of unrefined sugar. We are taught the Haitian Revolution was a messy slave revolt. That is a lie of convenience. It was a surgical, high-level military decapitation of the wealthiest colonial power on Earth, planned for years in the deepest silence of the night. Within the first hour of the uprising, a high-ranking French officer was found in his bed with a single, perfectly preserved white orchid placed in his open mouth. No one knew where it came from or what it meant, but the generals in Paris would spend the next decade and millions of francs trying to decode that floral message while their empire burned. The silence of the northern plains was broken on the night of August 14, 1791, at Bois-Caiman. The rain did not fall in drops. It fell in sheets of lead. This was the legendary wait-for-intake moment of Caribbean history. A high priest named Duddy Boukman stood before a gathering of people who had been legally classified as furniture. He didn't give a speech about hope. He gave a speech about the total erasure of the French identity. While the thunder rolled, a woman named Cécile Fatiman moved through the crowd. She was carrying the white orchid. She handed it to a man whose identity was masked by a hood of burlap. She was carrying the white orchid. She handed it to a man whose identity was masked by a hood of burlap. That man took the flower and disappeared into the tree line. This wasn't just a ritual. It was the activation of a sleeper cell network that spanned over 200 plantations. The logistics of the initial strike were terrifyingly efficient. By dawn, the horizon was a jagged line of orange and black. The sugar vats were not boiling molasses. They were being used as tactical barriers. The French planters woke up to a world that had been inverted. The people who had served their coffee at 6 in the morning were standing on their front lawns with torches by 6:15. This was the first great pattern interrupt of the century. The French relied on the wall of story that they were superior. The revolutionary forces relied on the fact that a machete does not care about the Enlightenment. The entire northern province was engulfed in a fire so bright that sailors 20 miles out at sea thought the sun was rising in the west. We are now looking at the forensic reality of the battlefield. The soil of Haiti is a complex mixture of volcanic clay and limestone, but in 1791, its chemical composition was altered by the sheer volume of organic decay. When you analyze the tactical movements of the Revolutionary Army, you see a mastery of guerrilla warfare that predates modern manuals by a century. They used terrain masking, utilizing the steep ravines of the Massif du Nord to hide movements of 10,000 men at a time. The French infantry, trained for the open fields of Europe, were trapped in kill zones where the humidity jammed their muskets and the heat warped their wooden stocks. A musket from this era had a failure rate of 15% in dry weather. In the Haitian jungle, that jumped to nearly 40%. The revolutionaries didn't need to outshoot the French. They just had to wait for the environment to disarm them. The escalation was not just physical, it was psychological. Toussaint Louverture, the mastermind who emerged from the smoke, was a man of cold, hard mathematics. He understood that the French economy was a house of cards. By 1802, Napoleon Bonaparte was the most powerful man in Europe, but he was losing sleep over a former coachman in the Caribbean. Napoleon sent his brother-in-law, Charles Leclerc, with 20,000 of his finest troops. These were veterans of the Italian campaigns, men who had stared down the Austrian Empire. When they landed in Le Cap, they found the city in ashes. The Haitians hadn't fled. They had burned their own homes, so the French would have nothing to occupy but cinders. You are standing on the ruins of a stone balcony. The smoke is so thick you can taste the charcoal on your tongue. To your left, the Caribbean Sea is a flat, mocking blue. To your right, the mountains are a wall of dark green. You hear a sound. It isn't a drum. It is the rhythmic clashing of steel against stone. Thousands of men are sharpening their blades at once. The sound vibrates in your teeth. You realize that there is no retreating to the ships. The ships are being watched by shore batteries. The French didn't know existed. You are trapped in a giant, open-air oven, and the fire is being stoked by people who have nothing left to lose. The terror isn't that you might die, it's that you have realized you were never the hero of this story. By 1803, the French army was a skeleton of itself. The Yellow Jack, yellow fever, was the silent executioner. It is a viral hemorrhagic disease transmitted by the Aedes aegypti mosquito. The symptoms are a descent into a private hell, high fever, back pain, and the terrifying black vomit, which is actually digested blood. The French soldiers were dying at a rate of 150 per day. General Leclerc himself succumbed to the fever, his last words reportedly a plea for his wife to leave the damned island. The revolution was no longer just a war of men, it was a biological blockade. The very blood in the French veins was turning against the empire. The midpoint reversal came at the Battle of Vertières. On November 18, 1803, Jean-Jacques Dessalines ordered a final suicidal charge against the French fortifications. This was not a mindless rush. It was a psychological break. The Haitian troops marched into the grapeshot singing revolutionary songs in French. They were using the language of their masters to celebrate their master's demise. The French commander, Rochambeau, was so stunned by the bravery of the Haitian general Capois La Morte, who continued to lead the charge even after his horse was blown out from under him, that he ordered a brief ceasefire just to applaud. The French realized they weren't fighting rebels. They were fighting a new world order, that they were too small to stop. The mystery of the White Orchid finally reached its resolution on January 1, 1804. As Dessalines stood to declare independence, the masked man from Bois Caiman stepped forward. He removed his burlap hood to reveal he was a high-ranking French turncoat who had been leaking naval codes to the revolution for over a decade. He handed the White Orchid back to Dessalines. The flower was not a symbol of peace. It was a coded map. The veins on the petals, when held under a specific light, traced the secret underwater tunnels and coastal caves where the French had stashed their emergency gold and gunpowder. The revolution had been funded by the very empire it destroyed, using a botanical key that had been sitting on the governor's desks for years. The legal outcome of this victory was the most radical document in human history. The Haitian Constitution of 1805 did not just end slavery. It declared that all citizens, regardless of their skin color, would henceforth be known as black. It was a total destruction of the concept of race as a tool of oppression. They didn't just win a territory. They rewired the human brain. But the world would not forgive them. France, backed by the global banking system, forced a debt of 150 million francs on the young nation. They literally made the survivors of slavery pay a freedom tax for the loss of the property being their own lives. The legacy of Haiti is not one of tragedy, but one of terrifying strength. They stood alone against a world of giants and won. They broke the back of the Atlantic slave trade, 40 years before the British and 60 years before the Americans. They did it with nothing but the iron in their blood and the fire in their hearts. Today we look at Haiti and see struggle, but we forget that the struggle was engineered by empires that feared the Haitian example more than they feared God. The wealth of the French banks today is still stained with the interest from that 80-year-long ransom. The question for the world today is not how we help Haiti, but how we repay the debt the world owes to the people who first defined what it truly means to be free. Was the Haitian Revolution a victory for human rights, or was it a warning that the Western world ignored for two centuries? If you were standing on the deck of a French ship in 1804, watching the flag of the New Republic rise over the smoking ruins of slavery, would you have seen a miracle or a nightmare? Tell me in the comments. Is the current state of the Caribbean a result of internal failure, or is it the lingering ghost of a 200-year-old economic execution?